From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Scottish band Belle and Sebastian has a cult following. The band was surrounded by mystery in its early days because the members declined to speak to the press. But now they talk. And on today's Fresh Air, the band's co-founder, lead singer, and songwriter Stuart Murdoch talks with us about everything from bubblegum music to having been the caretaker of the church he lived above and having to move back in with his parents after getting chronic fatigue syndrome. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut solo album by Jenny Lewis, former child actress and lead singer of the indie rock band Rilo Kiley, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Intuition, the new novel by Allegra Goodman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Since the band Bell and Sebastian formed 10 years ago in Glasgow, Scotland, they've developed a devoted cult following. If you haven't heard them, that might lead you to believe their music is esoteric or obscure. It's not. A Washington Post review described the band's new CD, The Life Pursuit, as a terrific pop album. In the online music magazine Pitchfork, Mark Hogan writes, "Spanning glam, soul, country, and 70s AM rock, this record is a deceptively wry, wickedly tuneful testament to the fragile beauty of faith in deities as well as in pop." My guest is the co-founder of the band, Stuart Murdoch. He sings and writes most of the songs. When the band started out, the members declined to speak to the press, but that changed a few years ago, and Murdoch turns out to be straightforward and open in talking about his life and music. Bell and Sebastian are on an American tour. Before we meet Stuart Murdoch, here's a track from The Life Pursuit. This is Another Sunny Day. Bell and Sebastian, Stuart Murdoch, welcome to Fresh Air. Bell and Sebastian got started, I think, when you were in college. Did you have a band when you were in high school?
No, not at all. Like I said, I couldn't write a song to save my life until much later.
So what got you writing songs?
Well, to be quite honest, I had a busy period when I was younger. I was at college and I was DJing and I was working as a roadie and working in a record shop And then I actually got unwell, and I had to give up all these pursuits one by one over a period of time. And then for quite a few years, in fact, for 7 years, I was pretty much out of the game. And it was during this period that that I found a lot of solace in being able to write a song.
So I had read a reference to CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome. Is that what you had?
Yes, pretty much. It was all sorts of post-viral difficulties. It was a major drag, as you could imagine.
Well, it must have been really awful to go from having this life where you're a DJ in clubs and, you know, living this really interesting life, going to all the record stores, and then you're, like, stuck at home. Did you move back in with your parents?
Yes, I had to. I moved back with my folks, and they put up with me, and pretty much I shed... Like you said, I shared everything for all my friends and activities. Not because I wanted to, but simply because I had to.
Sometimes when you're sick, it's hard to listen to music. It's hard to concentrate, and particularly if you have a headache or something like that, music can be really hard to listen to. When you had CFS, was it a time that you could listen to, absorb, and really care about music?
Yes, I think I became much fussier about the music I listened to. It had to be able to, like you say, absorb me and take me to another place, because at that point in your life when you're down and out, what you want is escapism. And so for a period of time, there was a core of groups and music that I listened to that took me somewhere else. And then I got very much into certain filmmakers at that point as well. But then there reached a point where I wanted more, and I wanted more escapism, and I wanted more fantasy, and that's when I started to invent it for myself.
Well, it must be hard to start something new and difficult, like writing songs when you're sick.
It felt like the one major thing that I had. When I started to do it, I realized that this could be a way out, and this could almost make up for what was happening to me.
Well, I'd like to play a song that you wrote that's on the first CD, the first Belle and Sebastian CD, Tiger Milk. And of course, I don't really know which songs you wrote because you don't include songwriter credits on the CDs. Why not?
I'm not really sure. It just, at the time, it just seemed unimportant.
Well, did you write Expectations?
Yes.
Good. That's the one I was going to play. So,
good.
So we'll listen to that. Do you want to say anything about writing the song? I mean, it's a story song. It's a character song, and I mean, I think of you in the song carrying on the tradition of, say, Ray Davies from the Kinks and Randy Newman. Of, you know, it's not a confessional song. It's not about you. It's about a character.
That's right. I have great fun with these characters, especially painting a character, someone who I would have thought was pretty hip at the time, and you sort of bring them to life in your imagination.
So you thought they were pretty hip at the time you were writing the song?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So this is about somebody who makes life-size models of the Velvet Underground in clay.
wouldn't that be fantastic? And this is because I imagine back to being, you know, much younger, and that time you love it when you're looking up towards the people in your class or in your school that are obviously way cooler than you, and you're wondering what goes on in their mind, and I just imagine this figure who was you know, modeling the Velvet Underground and had this project and this obsession, and I didn't even know who the Velvet Underground were.
Well, let's hear it. This is from the first Belle and Sebastian album, Tiger Milk, and this is Expectations.
Monday morning, wake up knowing that you gotta go to school. Tell your mum what to expect. She says it's right out of the blue. Do you wanna work at Debenhams? Cause that's what they expect. Starting lingerie, and Doris is your supervisor. And the head said that you always were a queer one from the start. For careers you say you wanna be remembered for your art. Your obsession gets you known throughout the school for being strange, making life-size models of the Velvet Underground in clay. In the queue for lunch they take the piss, you've got no appetite. And the rumour is you never go with boys and you are tight. So they jab you with a fork, you drop the tray and go berserk. While you're cleaning up the mess, the teacher's looking up your skirt. Hey, you've been used. Are you calm? Settle down. Write a song, I'll sing along. Soon you will know that you are sane. You're on top of the world again.
That's Belle and Sebastian. The song Expectations that we just heard was on their first album, Tiger Milk. It was written and sung by my guest, Stuart Murdoch. This seems to be really influenced by the group Love.
This is one of the groups, along with perhaps an American group called The Left Bank, and also a group called The Love and Spoonful,
mm-hmm.
And the English group The Zombies. Now, there's four groups that our group all revered.
I can see why.
Yeah.
So here, this is, it's your first album, and you have like strings on it. There's a trumpet. Did you have friends who could play those instruments in a rock setting, in a pop setting?
Well, I didn't know I had friends until. I quite honestly didn't know these people. They became my friends, but the story of the first LP was that I'd been trying to find these people for so long.
Well, people who you could make music with and felt connected to?
Absolutely. during the you know points in my you know when I wasn't feeling so good. And then all of a sudden, in this one period of time, and it was when I was just about to leave Scotland to actually move to California to try my luck there, that that I was asked to produce the Tiger Milk LP for a local college. And it was at that point that that I met the people that were to make the record.
Now, doesn't this record have something to do with some kind of competition?
That's right. The college in Glasgow, Stowe College, every year they sponsored a group or an artist to make a record. And so this year they somehow got hold of a demo tape of mine, and they asked me to make the record. And it, I think that was the inspiration for, well, it seemed to be the thing that brought these musicians together rather quickly. It was very fateful.
So getting back to the idea that there's like strings, trumpet on this CD, did you hear those sounds in your head? I mean, when you wrote the song, did you say, this needs a violin and a trumpet, and this is what they need to be playing? Did you hear the song that way in your mind?
Yes, absolutely. That was, if there was one thing about the sound of the fledgling Belle and Sebastian that I wanted, it was that the trumpet should be as important as the guitar, that the cello should be as important as the piano, and etc., and that I should form a small, compact Baroque unit that would be able to, play great pop lines.
So at what point were you in your recovery from chronic fatigue syndrome when you recorded Tiger Milk?
I was getting on better. And like I said, so many things were fateful around this time. I suddenly had a band of, seven people, and it was a lot to handle because obviously I was the leader and I was in charge of what we were doing. And I used to go home at night and think, how can I handle this? You know, these people, because it took quite a lot. But I think it was a good time. My energy was just coming together, really.
My guest is Stuart Murdoch, the lead singer and songwriter of the band Belle and Sebastian. Their new CD is called The Life Pursuit. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stuart Murdoch, the lead singer and songwriter of the Scottish band Belle and Sebastian. Their new CD is called The Life Pursuit. So when you were getting started and you're a band from Glasgow, did it help to be in Glasgow itself? Did it help to be a local band, or was that held against you?
Well, we didn't really care about what anybody else thought. Mm-hmm. We definitely felt as a group that we were deeply unfashionable. The sort of people that came together for the group that were misfits. They weren't hip at all in my book. They were sort of people that had rolled into Glasgow looking for something to do. But Isabel was very young, and she was just out of school and just starting college. And I know for a fact, if I just think about her for a second, that I think she would have found it very hard to fit into any sort of occupation if she hadn't have found the group at this point. And Stevie had been in a group before and was fed up with all that business, didn't want to be in a group, and I had to twist his arm to play music at all. It was a group of misfits, so we didn't really. But I think that helped in a way because we banded together and we didn't want anything to do with any of the other groups around at the time.
What made you feel unhip?
Well, it probably just healthy paranoia at the time. I can remember getting up in parties and I cringe when I think of it now, and almost forcing people to listen to songs that I'd written, you know, playing acoustically. And I can remember people sort of talking up their sleeves and thinking, oh, I wish this guy would shut up, or I wish this guy would go away. There was a distinct feeling in the Glasgow of this period that all the great music had been done. So why bother? You know, all these great records from the 60s had been made. So, you know, it was impertinent even to try and write another song. But this fueled me deeply. This made me want to make the most terrific records that I could imagine.
Well, the same year that you released your first album, Tiger Milk, 1996, you also released an album it came out the same year. And I want to play something from that album. It's called If You're Feeling Sinister. And the track I want to play, did you write Judy and the Dream of Horses?
Yes, I wrote pretty much all the early stuff, yes.
Okay, well,
yes,
good.
I wrote Judy. Yeah.
Good. This is a great song, and one of the things I find interesting about it as a record is that it starts out sounding like it's almost going to be like a Gilberto or Jobim bossa nova, and then the mood changes, and then, you know, the trumpet comes in. And so when I listen to your music, I just hear all these interesting different influences coming together to create your songs. Were you interested in bossa nova?
Not really. I was more interested in perhaps the second half of the, when it explodes into bubblegum pop. perhaps it still sounds a bit folky, that record. I think we could have a better go at it now. I mean, we were quite naive in our early days of production, but I always heard Judy as being a bit of bubblegum pop.
Let's hear it. This is Judy and the Dream of Horses from the Bell and Sebastian CD, If You're Feeling Sinister.
Judy, let's go for a walk. We can kiss and do whatever you want, but you will be disappointed. You will fall asleep with thoughts in your hands. You're just trying to find and keep the dream of horses. And the song she wrote was Judy and the Dream of Horses. Dream of Horses. Dream of Horses. Dream of Horses. The best looking boys are taken. The best looking girls are staying. Write another song about your dream of horses. Write a song about your dream of horses. Call it Judy and the Dream of Horses. Call it Judy and the Dream of Horses. Your dream of horses.
That's Judy and the Dream of Horses from the Bill and Sebastian CD, If You're Feeling Sinister, from 1996. I guess Stuart Murdoch sang it and wrote the song. And they have a new CD, which is called The Life Pursuit. Now, before we heard this track, you said that you were really thinking of bubblegum pop. When you think bubblegum, who do you think of?
Oh, I'm just thinking of something like Sugar Sugar by the Archies.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is basically, I mean, that's my taste. That's the kind of song I just love. I love just turning on the radio, hearing classic hits from the 60s and 70s.
Now, it's only recently, well, fairly recently, that you started doing interviews. For the first few years that Bell and Sebastian recorded, you didn't do interviews, and there was a lot of mystery surrounding the band and the people in it. What was your reason for not doing interviews?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. I don't want to bore you, you know, with the reasoning. It just seemed at some point that it was easier just not to do them. You know, being young and rather paranoid, as I mentioned before, and naive, starting this group was the biggest thing in my life, and I just thought it was terrific. And then I was somewhat disappointed when we started speaking to the British music press right at the start of the group. They seemed to want to control what we were, or they seemed to have a problem with us simply doing what we did. And it's like they wanted to mould us. And I got rather paranoid about this. It just seemed easier to switch off.
Stuart Murdoch is the lead singer and songwriter of the band Bell and Sebastian. The band's new CD is called The Life Pursuit. Murdoch will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Intuition, a novel by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls.
Come home late, I love your soul. I never forget you in my prayers. I never have a bad day to report. You're my picture on the wall. You're my vision in the hall. My eyesight's fading, my hearing's dim. I can't get in shot for the state I'm in. I'm a danger to myself, I've been starting fights at the party at the club on a Saturday night. But I don't get disapproving from my girl. She gets all the highlights.
Comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Intuition, a novel by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. From GM, offering vehicles that can run on E85 ethanol, an alternative fuel made from corn. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Rabbit Fur Coat, the debut solo album by Jenny Lewis. Maureen Corrigan reviews Intuition, the new novel by Allegra Goodman. And we continue our interview with Stuart Murdoch of Bell and Sebastian.
Well, look at the kid from school. He's teaching mamas and papas how to be a little cool. He's changing fashion the way he dress. Attracted to old. The hoodies wear the money for the kid with the will to funk. He dances in secret, he's a part-time punk. Now she's getting off the plane. She wants to write a thesis on the population of the privilege. The kid's fighting up the lane. The shoplifting, just drifting like the switchblade on the crossbar. If there's trouble, she's got the moves. She's taken an elementary class in Kung Fu. A lamp I'm washing in the laundrette. You can put some money on it. You can place a little bet that when I see my washing, the black will be grey and the white will be grey, but the blues are still blue. I'm crying now.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Stuart Murdoch, the lead singer and songwriter of the Scottish indie band Bell and Sebastian. The band has a new CD called The Life Pursuit. You used to live above a church, and you were the church's caretaker. You did this for how many years?
Maybe about 7 or 8 years.
Mm-hmm. And this was, place this for us chronologically, this was after you had recovered from the chronic fatigue. Were you already recording?
This was precisely at the time that the group came together. Mm-hmm. I guess I'd been, you know, living from sort of room to room around Glasgow and just, you know, getting on with my sort of gloomy existence up to a point. And then I attended a church, and the minister knew that I didn't really have a permanent place to stay, and he offered that I should stay in the church building, the church hall, and look after the premise, and not pay rent. So it was a nice arrangement where I did this job and I lived there for free. And this was at exactly the same time that the group came together at the January 1996, which was a couple of months before Tiger Milk was recorded.
So what was it like to live above a church? I mean, did you feel the specialness of the, like some churches in particular have a very either spiritual or at least beautiful and in some situations ancient or old feeling about them. I don't know what kind of church this was, whether this was a little corner church or, you know, a beautiful and very old church.
Yes, well, there was a mixture of that. There was the main church building, which was just 100 yards up the street. And this was the smaller building where all the clubs and societies used to meet. And they had sort of social gatherings in the hall. And so it was busy all the time with the groups, with the old ladies coming in to drink their coffee in the morning, or the mothers and toddlers coming in the afternoon. And there would be bridge clubs and choirs and drama clubs and cubs and scouts. And so it was busy, it was social. And I must admit, I liked it. And I there was a special atmosphere from the place. And I didn't take that for granted. I used to, you know, when I was cleaning up at night and everybody had gone, and the huge hall had a special atmosphere with the street light coming in, and I loved that.
What kind of church is it that you belong to and lived above?
It was the Church of Scotland, which is kind of close to the Presbyterian Church in America,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is a Christian gathering, and very very friendly. It just happened to be the closest church. I woke up one Sunday morning in the early 90s and for some reason thought I'd try and find a church, and it happened to be the one that was closest.
Well, I thought I'd play a song that I'm assuming you wrote, and you can tell me if you did.
Yeah.
It's called If You Find Yourself Caught in Love. And, you know, it's a song that certainly acknowledges religion. Did you write this one?
Yes, I did. Uh-huh.
Do you want to talk about the song a little bit?
Yes, it is a bit of a funny one because it has a certain gospel sort of hint to it. And it's something at the time when I was writing it, I thought, oh, should I be so overt? Because I've often sort of couched any religious overtones in, you know, within characters or something like that in the past. But this is a bit more out there. And then I just thought, come on, we've been doing this for years. Why not? You know, why not just be a bit more straightforward?
Was it hard to figure out a way to get some acknowledgement of God in a song without it sounding like Christian rock?
Yes, it's a fine line, isn't it? I mean, I don't mean to be down on Christian rock, but it's not my cup of tea. So I guess you just got to do what you feel all the time. Be led by taste. You have to do what you like.
Uh-huh. Okay, so this is from the Belle and Sebastian CD, Dear Catastrophe Waitress. The song is If You Find Yourself Caught in Love, Say a Prayer to the Man Above.
If you find yourself caught in love, say a prayer to the man above. Thank him for everything you know. You should thank him for every breath you blow. If you find yourself caught in love, say a prayer to the man above. Thank him for every day you pass. You should thank him for saving your sorry ass. If you're single but looking out, you must raise your prayer to a shout. Another partner must be found, someone to take your life beyond. Another TV, I love 1999. Just one more box of cheap wine. If you find yourself caught in love, say a prayer to the man above.
But if you don't listen to the voices, then my friend, you'll soon run out of choices. What a pity it would be, 'cause you talk of freedom, don't you see? The only freedom that you'll ever really know is written in books from long ago. Give up your will to him that wants you, things will change. I'm not saying overnight, you've got to start somewhere. Start by kidding on your care.
That's If You Find Yourself Caught in Love from the Bell and Sebastian CD, Dear Catastrophe Waitress. My guest Stuart Murdoch wrote and sung that song, and they have a new CD now. So let's try to bring ourselves up to date a little bit. You're no longer living above the church. Do you live in Glasgow?
I actually just moved out of the church last year.
Last year, wow. What was it like when fans must have known you live there. So, and it's certainly got to be an easy place to find.
Yes, well, I think our fans have always been very respectful of the group. So that's been nice from the start. And whenever we have, you know, run into fans, or whenever the fans have come to the church, which has happened quite regularly, they get a little bit more than they bargained for, because perhaps they want to creep in and sit quietly in one of the pews at the back and maybe spot me from afar or whatever. But they get pounced on by the congregation, by the ladies in the church, and they have to come and drink tea and sign the sign the visitor's book and explain where they're from. So they're made welcome.
Have you sung in a church choir there?
Yes, I still sing in the choir, that's right.
Well, what are the songs like?
Well, they're terrific. I like traditional, you know, English, Scottish church music. I think it's terrific. I sing tenor, or at least I try to sing tenor, and it's actually during the time that I've sang there, it's forced me to project a lot more, and my voice has become stronger.
My guest is Stuart Murdoch, the lead singer and songwriter of the band Bell and Sebastian. Their new CD is called The Life Pursuit. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stuart Murdoch, the lead singer and songwriter of the Scottish band Bell and Sebastian. Their new CD is called The Life Pursuit. One of the things you did when you were sick is watch a lot of movies at home. You wrote the songs for, or at least some of the songs, for the Todd Solondz movie, Storytelling. While you were watching movies at home a lot when you were sick, did you think a lot about the music in the films, whether they were, you know, like songs on the soundtrack or the underscoring?
Yes, absolutely. I used to fantasize about scoring a film for a New York-based filmmaker, Hal Hartley.
Mm.
And because I used to be somewhat obsessed by his films in the early 90s. But many others, yeah.
Does he know that? Did you ever ask to work with him?
Yeah, well, I used to write to him on a regular basis. And I'm just thinking back to those days where he could quite easily have thought I was some sort of nut. But to his credit, he wrote me a nice letter back, and he sent me a CD of the music that was on his films.
So does this affect how you respond to fans who write you, since you wrote, you know, as a fan to Hal Hartley?
Well, amongst others, I was basically a fan. I loved music and was loving films for years and years, and I had all this spare time to fantasize, and so I used to write to people quite regularly. I don't really know what I wanted out of them. And it's true, there's a reciprocal agreement here that we get many letters and emails from our fans, and I wish I had time to answer them all, but at least I know what they're going through, or at least I know what their thought processes are.
Do you listen to as much music as you used to? You know, you were a DJ, then you were homesick and listened to a lot of music. Now you're writing songs, you're on the road sometimes. How has music as a listening experience changed in your life?
It's true. It's faded out. Now, this might seem very conceited to say this, but in the 80s and, you know, the early 90s, I absorbed music. I just drank it in. And then, but as soon as I started to write music, I like to listen to the music in my head, and I still like that. I like to walk around and listen to the music in my head, and that's the way that songs come. That's the way that they arrive. And so I like to give myself plenty of space and for that to happen. But in between those times, I love to go back to the records that I love, rather than particularly seeking out lots of new music. I do lean on the records that I loved for years and years, and they're still a constant inspiration to me.
You know, I'm interested in how songs come to you. You know, again, you didn't start writing songs until you were, what, in your early 20s? Would that be it, about?
Probably about, right, 24 even, yes.
Which is kind of old in a way. Like a lot of people who write songs are writing songs in their teens, and there's always original music going through their head. When you decided you wanted to write songs, was it an act of will that you, like, sat down and thought, I'm going to write a song, and did you just, like, consciously craft it, or was there just, like, music coming to you in your head?
Yes, well, I would say it certainly wasn't an act of will, and what came to me at first was a desperation to communicate in some way or form, and it was really through words, and it was almost just by accident that I found that instead of simply writing bad poetry, that you could write bad poetry with some melody attached, and then you could get away with it.
Did you write poetry when you were in high school or college?
Well, no, not really. It just, this, you know, urge just came to me a few years after I'd gotten sick. But in a sense, you know, pop music is bad poetry with a sweetener. And so this is what I found out. I sat down at the piano and I formed my first bad poem and with a melody, and then I never looked back.
Well, Stuart Murdoch, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Stuart Murdoch is the lead singer and songwriter of the band Bell and Sebastian. Their new CD is called The Life Pursuit. Tonight, Bell and Sebastian will play at the 9:30 Club in Washington, D.C., along with the band The New Pornographers. You can hear the show online through a live webcast from NPR, starting around 8 p.m. There's a link for more information at our website, freshair.npr.org. The lead singer of the indie rock band Rilo Kiley started her career as a child actress. Jenny Lewis had small roles in TV shows like Growing Pains and Mr. Belvedere. Lewis has just released her first solo album with the LA-based sister duo The Watson Twins. It's called Rabbit Fur Coat, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
If I run uphill, I'm out of breath. If I spend all of my money, then I've got no money left. If I place all of my chips on only one bet, I'm all in. And it's a surefire bet I'm gonna die. So I'm taking up praying on Sunday nights. And it's not that I believe in your almighty, but I might as well, as in
Rabbit Fur Coat is an odd, interesting thing. It's a beautiful-sounding collection of songs with knotted, clotted lyrics that become, upon repeated listenings, slightly more clear and occasionally even better, more forceful, yet mysterious. The key to understanding Lewis's appeal is to hear beyond her gentle voice to the troubled soul beneath. Take the title song, for example. At first, it seems a rambling narrative about her mother's rabbit fur coat, a valuable object that's stolen and causes much pain and prolonged suffering. But Lewis eventually makes the coat a metaphor for ambition, lust, and greed, a way to express doubt about her own pursuit of a prominent pop music career. Or as she sums up the superficial gain in a phrase, a mansion house and rabbit fur coat.
I was of poor folk, but my mother had a rabbit fur coat. Then a girl of less character pushed her down the LA River and over that rabbit fur coat. She put a knife to her throat, and over that rabbit fur coat, when my ma refused, the girl kicked dirt on her blouse. Stay away from my mansion house. My mother really suffered.
I think it's kind of amusingly perverse that Jenny Lewis's small record label has chosen the song Rise Up With Fists as the album's first single. It's Lewis's attempt at a Bob Dylan-esque accusatory anthem. And what Lewis has most in common with her role model in this case is her insistence upon vehemence about mankind's mistakes, even in the midst of images that collide and even negate each other. It's a gospel song that questions whether gospel truth exists.
What are you changing? Who do you think you're changing? You can't change things. We're all stuck in our ways. It's like trying to clean the ocean. What do you think you can drain it? Well, it was poison and dry.
When I said gospel truth before, I meant gospel in a worldly, not a biblical sense. So does Lewis in the song Born Secular, a gorgeous waltz that makes great use of the rich harmonies of the Watson twins. In the key verse, she says, quote, I heard that he walked the earth, God goes where he wants to, and who knows where he is not in me. I've talked to people who hear this as Lewis's proclamation of agnosticism, or possibly atheism. But I parse that last line literally, who knows where he is not in me, as a double negative that means he is in her. Of course, whether she wants God in her is another story.
I was born secular and inconsolable. I heard that he walked the earth. God goes where he wants, and who knows where he is not in me.
One non-original on Rabbit Fur Coat is a stunt that Lewis very nearly pulls off, a nicely ragged cover of the Traveling Wilburys' Handle Me With Care, with Lewis taking the George Harrison lead vocal, and a trio of indie rock stars, Connor Oberst, Matt Ward, and Death Cab for Cutie's Ben Gibbard, filling out the Bob Dylan, Roy Orbison, Tom Petty parts. In an insightful review of this album in Blender magazine, the critic Ann Powers compared Jenny Lewis to the character of Meredith Grey on the hit TV show Grey's Anatomy, essentially suggesting that Lewis presents a wistful, vaguely depleted soulfulness that's actually a bit deeper than it seems. I agree. For all its surface loveliness, Lewis's music is the work of someone who's thought a lot about the price of success, the price exacted by committing to love, and knows that saying, I don't care, is just another way of saying that you care a great deal, but it hurts too much to admit.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Jenny Lewis's CD, Rabbit Fur Coat. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Allegra Goodman's new novel, Intuition. This is Fresh Air. Allegra Goodman's short stories have appeared in The New Yorker and Slate, and she's the author of best-selling novels and short story collections such as Caterskill Falls and The Family Markowitz. Her latest novel is called Intuition, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's one of those novels that makes a reader excited about the art of fiction.
I've had people tell me proudly that they don't read novels. Nothing some writer makes up, these folks say, could be as interesting or worthwhile to read as history or biography or even true crime. I've also had people who do read fiction tell me that they don't read contemporary novels. Nothing written in modern times, these purists say, can touch the great books of the 18th and 19th century. It's usually a wearying task to argue with folks who espouse such generalized literary prejudices. I've tried rattling off recommended reading lists of contemporary novels, but most naysayers don't bother to listen. Now, though, I've got a new comeback to those who dismiss contemporary fiction. I'm just going to hit them over the head with Allegra Goodman's new novel, Intuition, and hope it knocks some sense and humility into them. Intuition is an intricate novel of ideas, ideas made flesh in characters who labor away at a cancer research institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The directors of the institute are Sandy Glass, an oncologist who's good at raising grant money and garnering publicity, and Marion Mendelsohn, a scientist whose dedication to slow exactitude is legendary among the postdoctoral protégés working in the lab. One day, one of those protégés, a brilliant rake named Cliff Banneker, finds out that the tumors in some of his cancer-ridden lab mice have shrunk, perhaps because of the virus he's been injecting them with. The lab tries to tamp down its excitement, to hew to scientific skepticism, but after so many years of dogged research that's yielded zip, elation trumps caution, and word of Cliff's success soon leaks out. That's when Cliff's girlfriend, a shy fellow postdoc, reluctantly voices her doubts about the rigor of his method, maybe even his honesty. The resulting debacle rips apart relationships inside and outside of the lab and propels the principal players all the way to Washington to congressional hearings on scientific integrity. By the time the dust has settled, the crucial things the characters believed about themselves, all their fixed certainties and their allegiances, have shifted again and again. In Intuition, Goodman is posing the age-old question of epistemology. How do we ever know the truth? To tackle that question, Goodman, like her characters, takes up a microscope. She's a literary miniaturist who keeps slowly rotating the focus until a seething cosmos emerges under her lens. I can't think of any other book I've read, fiction or nonfiction, that so vividly conveyed the charged world of research, where a tight set of characters with advanced degrees work together, compete for the same few jobs, and inevitably sleep together. Cliff thinks of himself and his fellow researchers as miners or submariners who sometimes crack in the sterile, claustrophobic confines of the lab. But I'm making Intuition sound too high-minded and grim, when in fact, like other great novelists in the miniaturist tradition, Jane Austen, Barbara Pym, Allegra Goodman not only finds wisdom in small details, but also wit. Some humor here derives from the character's ungenerous mutterings about others. Thinking jealously about his daughter's Harvard boyfriend, the lab's egotistical co-director, Sandy Glass, himself a Jew, gripes, "Jeff the squash player, Jeff Udelstein, that ridiculous name. Not just an ordinary Jewish name, but an overstuffed knish of an appellation. Udelstein was halfway between a yodel and a strudel." Other passages are not exactly funny, but rather delightful. They make you smile because they nail so precisely a mood or a character type. Describing Sandy's work with his hospital patients, Goodman observes, "Sandy's sparkling savoir-faire made him a stellar oncologist. He radiated hope to every patient. Instead of death, he dwelt on baseball games and the Boston Marathon. He set himself squarely against every cancerous cell and so inspired his patients into battle that magically, even the most sophisticated believed that he could never fail them. Their worry was that in dying, they might fail him." Intuition is packed with clarifying moments like that one. The novel is a superb testament to the one mental power that Goodman's researcher characters feel they have to rigorously rein in, imagination.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Intuition, a new novel by Allegra Goodman. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the history of the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories and the controversies that have surrounded them. We talk with Gershom Gorenberg about his new book, The Accidental Empire. He's a former associate editor and columnist for the Jerusalem Report. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Intuition, a novel by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. From GM, offering vehicles that can run on E85 ethanol, an alternative fuel made from corn. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.